it's not about money. I mean, it is about money, but the real concern is about power. And I would say, you know, once somebody hits the top 0.1%, 40 million and up, they've already bought their fancy houses, they've bought their private jet, their children are set, their grandchildren are set. Then they start to buy senators and news outlets. That's when it really gets dangerous and precarious for the rest of us.
Welcome to the Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Chuck Collins, the heir to the Oscar Mayer fortune, gave away his millions to progressive political causes while he was in his 20s. Ever since, the resident of Guilford, Vermont, has fought to expose how the rich make themselves richer at everyone else's expense. In his new book, Burned by Billionaires: How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and Planet, Collins shows how the actions of the top 0.01% have dire consequences for everyone else. He argues that as a result of how the rich rig the system in their favor, working people pay the price in higher taxes, fewer affordable houses, and a healthcare system stripped of health. Collins is a senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he co-edits inequality.org. He writes the Oligarch Watch column for The Nation. I began by asking Chuck Collins to describe his own relationship with wealth.
Well, I did win the lottery at birth. My great-grandfather was the meatpacker Oscar Mayer. So I grew up in a kind of, I don't know, fourth generation of a hot dog dynasty, you could say. It's no longer a family business, however. And when I did have the good fortune to inherit some money in my 20s, I decided to give it away. It's a longer story, but I basically just didn't want to be part of this growing concentration of wealth and power. Little did I know 40 years later, just where we would be. But it has given me some insight into the wealthy and sort of a front row seat on the how the industries that sort of prop up the wealthy, hide their wealth, and that sort of thing.
You've described the moment we're in as a second Gilded Age. For those listeners who weren't around during the first Gilded Age, tell us what this refers to and what was the Gilded Age and what's a second one?
Yeah, the Gilded Age was sort of that era after the Civil War, 1880s up till First World War, that there was partly the riches of the industrial era started to pool upward. So you saw the rise of the robber baron fortunes, the Rockefellers and the Carnegies and these kind of super wealthy families. And it did give rise to a lot of concern. It gave rise to the sort of rural farmer populist movement, people who were worried that too much concentrated wealth and power would undermine a self-governing republic. And it did, in the end, led to the first inheritance tax and the national income tax and policies to break up monopolies. So in response to the first Gilded Age, people came together and said, no, we don't want to become England. We don't want to have hereditary aristocracies of wealth. And so we reverted back to a much more equal society.
The first Gilded Age did also spin off some social goods. You know, Andrew Carnegie famously funded libraries all over the place and other things that you may be more familiar with. But there today, it seems to be this just hoarding and super yachts and mega mansions all over the place with very little spill-off. And perhaps Bill Gates might be the exception to that because he actually cared about global health along the way to accumulating his billions. But that doesn't seem to be the case with, say, Elon Musk. So what's the difference between the tycoons of then and the tycoons of now?
Well, it's true that, Andrew, we can look around and see the Carnegie libraries and maybe the four or five generation later legacy of Rockefeller beneficence. But these were SOBs in their day. I mean, they you know, Carnegie, maybe by the time they start to think about meeting their maker, they kind of look back and say, maybe I should do something good for humanity. That may be the case with today's robber barons, today's billionaires, but it's hard to group them all together. I would say right now there's a group of people that are using their wealth and power to rig the rules to extract more wealth and power, and that's kind of the era we're living in. There's a handful of billionaires that I would say are, like Mackenzie Scott, who was married to Jeff Bezos and has been, in her words, emptying the vault, moving money to solve social problems. Chuck Feeney, who inspired the Giving Pledge, made his money from duty free and pretty much gave it all away in his life and, lived in a small apartment in San Francisco, no longer as a billionaire. So there are people that are sort of in that Carnegie, spread the wealth, share the wealth at the end of your life perspective. But yeah, I think what we're living through does feel like this whole other era, really, of hoarding and selfishness.
Well, explain the difference in look, feel, and actual dollars and cents between the first Gilded Age and the second one going on now.
Well, the first Gilded Age had a lot of similarities. There were 400 wealthy families that, by some estimates, may have had 40 to 50% of all the wealth in the country. We don't have the sort of apples to apples data to compare. But what I think we're seeing is, for instance, during the pandemic, 2020 to 2022, the rise of billionaire wealth. The flow of wealth, not just to the sort of 1%, but the top 1/10 of 1% in the billionaire class, is dizzying. The billionaires went in, the US billionaires' combined wealth at the beginning of the pandemic was under $3 trillion. Today it's $7.8 trillion. It doubled and accelerated over the pandemic. So there's a way in which, as m the rest of us become more precarious, and particularly the bottom 60, 70% of the population become more precarious, that updraft of wealth is really unprecedented. And it's probable that we will see before the end of the decade the first trillionaire, which is nothing to celebrate.
What happened to create so many millionaires and billionaires?
Well, I think it's important to realize that, this is not an act of nature. This is not, the natural order of things. This is the result of several decades of public policies that have been rigged and tipped in favor of the billionaire class and of the super rich. Tax policy, trade policy, what government spends money on and doesn't spend money on. You can kind of go down the list, but we have to realize it's a result of billionaire capture. The billionaires have captured our political system. They've pretty much own the Republican Party and a lot of the Democratic Party, and they have pushed an agenda that is not friendly to the rest of us. And so it's not an accident. It is the result of laws and rules and policies, and the fact that you have then billionaires who can not just lobby Congress, but block really popular reforms, block things that would help the vast majority of people. And they can buy the news organizations and control the conversation using their considerable wealth and power. So that's the moment we're in, really.
How does this accumulation of money and power, but most of all money, affect everyone? Isn't there just a limitless pool of cash?
Yeah, I guess I would say it's not about money. I mean, it is about money, but the real concern is about power. And I would say, once somebody hits the top 1/10 of 1%, 40 million and up, they've already bought their fancy houses, they've bought their private jet, their children are set, their grandchildren are set. Then they start to buy senators and news outlets. That's when it really gets dangerous and precarious for the rest of us. So, part of the reason I wrote this book is, had enough conversations with people who said, it's nothing the billionaire's doing that's hurting me, or it doesn't matter how rich the rich are. Well, actually, quite the opposite. Pretty much everything you care about is undermined by that concentration of wealth and power. Your health, your housing, the quality of your environment. Down the list, this touches each of us acutely. And it really, we should be taking it very personally as we go through our days and think about, whoa, that the billionaires have, taken over my veterinary clinic. Now they want to charge me more to get vaccines for my cat. It's because of the billionaire grabbing and concentration of wealth and power that we're having to pay more and get less.
Well, let's take healthcare, which is something that I think is a, often a stressor or at a minimum a frustration for everyone. How have the wealthy stripped the health out of healthcare?
If you think about, the first hospitals in this country were usually started by religious orders and civic groups that were trying to, improve public health. Now we see huge sectors of the health economy being acquired by billionaire-backed private equity companies. They're buying up hospitals, they're buying up specialty health clinics, and they are trying to squeeze more out of it. So healthcare has become an arena for billionaire wealth extraction. And the whole healthcare industry is more and more becoming, and that's a sixth of the US economy. And then there's a sort of larger sociological research that shows when societies become so unequal, it undermines public health and mental health for everyone in the society, because there's a breakdown in solidarity. And we could see that in the pandemic. If the billionaires are laughing all the way to the bank and other people who are precarious and at risk or in frontline jobs are making these huge sacrifices, that erodes any kind of sense of public well-being and public health. And ultimately, our individual body health is very much connected to the health of the whole society and the community. So all of that is undermined by extreme inequality.
Here in Vermont, we are experiencing an intense housing crisis where you look at some of the availability of housing around places like Burlington, and in certain kind of middle and lower income ranges, there's nothing. How has this concentration of wealth contributed to that?
I think we have a housing crisis. One way to think about it is being supercharged by these inequalities. There's always been a sort of dynamic of gentrification, of wealthy people bidding up the cost of housing, or second and third home buyers buying up land and housing. But all that is happening like with t to the 10th time. I mean, we're just, and there's a couple things. One is, the billionaire private equity people are moving in. They're moving into Vermont and other regions, and they're buying up land. They're buying up single family houses. People used to be able to buy a single family house at a certain point in their life, maybe, and if they earned enough income. Now they're stuck in a rental housing, and the billionaires are buying up the single family housing to rent them back to middle class folks, all the way to people who have lost their housing. Billionaires are. Private equity firms are buying up mobile home parks. There's one of these multimillionaires was quoted as saying, buying a mobile home park is like buying a Waffle House where the customers are chained to the booths. They can't go anywhere. Well, that's true if you live in a mobile home park. And guess what? The billionaires are buying up mobile home parks. There are fortunately in parts of New England, resident-owned, cooperative-owned mobile home parks. We were able to get in there. That's one of my early jobs in my 20s was helping mobile home tenants buy their parks, mostly in New Hampshire. I think what we're seeing is, yeah, the housing crisis is acute. It's just getting worsened by these inequalities. I should also mention, the U.S. and Vermont are very attractive to global investors. Billionaires from around the world now are moving their money to the US because we're a tax haven, because we have an orderly real estate market, and they are spreading their wealth around and buying up land and housing in all over the US. And that adds to the fuel to the fire, if you will. So There are solutions embedded in that. We could tax luxury transfers of real estate. We could tax absentee-owned real estate and put it into a fund like the Vermont Housing Conservation Board or something like that, where the money goes to preserving permanent affordable housing. So the solutions are sometimes embedded with the problem, and I think so in the case of housing.
We hear a lot about the racial wealth gap. Explain what that is and give us kind of a sense of the some of the dollars and cents of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's not surprising that there's a big gap between, say, the wealth of people of color, blacks and Latinos and native folk, and white households. And that can go back even to, I mean, it goes back centuries, but even in recent times after World War II, we as a society made huge investments in housing, affordable housing, and the GI Bill for returning veterans. But those were exclusive. They were excluded people of color. So, some of I have an uncle on one side of my family, not the wealthy hot dog side of the family, but the Ohio farming family who got the Farmer's Home Loan in the post-World War II years and, bought their first farm with a 1% 40-year fixed loan. And that really put them on the wealth building train generations down the line. So people of color were excluded from that. So, today, 70% of white households own their home, but only about 45% of African American households own their home. Totally connected to the rules and investments that we made. I would argue that this current billionaire oriented economy is good for dynasties. They're really focused on building multi-generational wealth dynasties for the rich, but that is not good for people who are not born wealthy. If your parents didn't own a home, chances are you're not going to be able to get into the housing market, and it's just increasing precariousness for people of color. It's the same dynamics that's affecting working class whites, but because there's this historic legacy of racial inequality, it only makes those gaps even greater. One statistic is how many households have, 3 months or less of financial reserves to fall back on. At this point, it's like 25% of African American households have 3 months or less, and white households, it's about 10%. So you can see that racial wealth divide really does affect a sense of well-being for many, many people.
So the Trump administration has brought into sharp relief how a plutocracy or oligarchy has now taken charge, and nothing kind of captures that as much as the image of the world's richest man, Elon Musk, wielding a chainsaw and literally dismembering the government, gutting social services and such. What do you see going on here, Chuck? I mean, this feels like, the revenge of who? Of the robber barons. Just riff a little on what you see happening all around us.
Well, this is the, I guess it's the natural outgrowth of 5 decades of concentrated wealth. You literally have the billionaire capture. You have the billionaires lining up behind a one particular presidential candidate who has totally delivered for the billionaire class. To the point where our political system is captured. I mean, we have this government shutdown now, and they are using that government shutdown as a way to shrink government, lay off workers, and not even or we're not even going to publish unemployment rates and the data necessary for us to understand what's happening in the economy. So it's sort of we're living in this like perfect storm. The Supreme Court has been captured, Congress has been captured, popular alternatives that would benefit the wider society are essentially being blocked. When it comes to energy and climate change, you've got the we're shutting down the windmills and we're keeping the coal plants open. All of that is part of this very short-term, kind of like take the money and run moment where the billionaires are just like, let's just loot. Let's take whatever's there and put it in our pockets. And they're not even hiding that fact. I mean, so, on the other hand, it is kind of a wake-up call. I mean, we can be like, wow, this is what it looks like. This is what it feels like and looks like to live in an oligarchy. It is not a nice place for 99% of the population to live. It's particularly precarious if you are brown or have a name that Anglos can't pronounce easily. You are a target, but frankly, they're coming after everybody. And think about all the farmers I know who voted for Trump, some of whom live in Vermont. They are experiencing something they had no idea that they were in for. And I think that's generally true. And I anticipate that the sleeping giant of American apathy is going to get woken up. James Baldwin used to talk about the cult of what did he say? I'll skip that phrase, sorry. Anyway, I think we are heading into a tremendous wake-up moment. I'm actually confident that as people start to see how their pockets are getting picked, that they will wake up and want to push back on this oligarchic capture of our society.
You know, the very notion or phrase inequality speaks of something that's out of balance that cannot sustain. And we know throughout history, some of the biggest social upheavals and even wars have been preceded by gross inequality. It's hard to see it from where we are, but what do you see kind of stirring at sort of the eating away at the foundations of the system we currently have?
Yeah, there's a historian, Peter Turchin, who described this moment quite well. And he studies what happens to self-governing societies and republics where there's this such a tremendous imbalance of wealth and power. And one of that dynamic is the bottom 60% of the population becomes more precarious. Well, certainly that is the case now. And then you see this huge updraft and concentration of wealth and power. And as you allude to, that leads to breakdown. Breakdown in social norms, breakdown in society. The wealth pump of wealth that's being pumped from the bottom to the top and the middle to the top is like kicking into high gear. So it often has led to depression, war, but also revolution or hopefully nonviolent democratic transitions where, society regroups and says, no, we don't want to go down this path and we're going to reverse course. And we know how to do that. Even in the years after World War II, after the first Gilded Age and after World War II, we had a shared prosperity economy. We taxed wealth at high levels and invested in access to education and housing and things that help non-wealthy people have decent lives. We know the program, and that program is blocked by the billionaire oligarchs right now. But we know if we can recapture our democratic political system from the oligarchs, we know what the program is to create a healthy society. So yeah, I think we're living through a rare historic moment where we're on a very precarious we're at a precarious inflection, as I say.
Well, how does a mass movement successfully challenge an oligarchy? And where have you seen that succeed? To say a little bit more about that.
Well, even in our own US history, the populist movement that gave that arose during the first Gilded Age. I just joined my local Grange. I got inducted into my local Grange down here in Guilford, Vermont. It's a pretty interesting ritual. I encourage people to. The Grange was a movement of farmers and rural folks pushing back against monopoly power. They pushed back against the railroad monopolies. They became the foundation of what became the Progressive Party, the Populist Party and Populist Movement. And they pressed for things like a progressive income tax, a tax on inherited wealth, a breaking up of corporate monopolies, and reforms to expand democratic norms and practices. I think we're at a very similar moment. We have to push back against, we have to have tax policies that truly tax the wealthy. The ultra rich have pretty much opted out of paying taxes. I'm talking about people in that 50, 40, $50 million up group. They are using all kinds of trusts and offshore systems and all kinds of ways to avoid tax. We have to have a meaningful tax on wealth and higher incomes, and we have to tax that wealth and invest it in ways that rebuild the good, healthy commonweal. So we know from our own history, and we know in the history after World War II, what that program was. And they were mass movements. And I think the next month we're going to see, millions of people in the street, October 18th, No King's Day, people pushing back against ICE abductions in different parts of the community. There is an awakening that we have never seen. And I think that's key. And we have to say, look, we're not going to vote for people who are going to be, lapdogs of the billionaires, or who are going to just like support the billionaire agenda. And we're going to see people run for Congress and win and run for higher office saying, I'm not going to, I want an economy that works for everybody, not just the billionaires.
Yet, I mean, we do face the reality that Trump draws a lot of support from working class people, particularly working class white people, but not just whites, who feel abandoned by the Democrats. As Bernie Sanders said, the working class left the Democrats because the Democrats left them. So, how do you see, that changing? They have remained a very loyal base of support for Trump. Recent polling suggests that his base has really not budged much.
I think it's going to be hard for the true believers who are pretty attached and whose media diet is almost entirely, Fox News or Newsmax or places where you really are exposed to a kind of alternative reality. But I see all kinds of cracks. I mean, I think about farmers who are rethinking, really, is this helping me? I think of a lot of working class voters who are starting to see they're very personally affected by some of these changes. I think, and there are cracks within the billionaire elites that we should be paying attention to. Some of the billionaires think we should be addressing climate change, and others are saying, oh no, we want to keep those coal plants open. So we need to look for the cracks within the elites as well as sort of building that mass movement. And here in Vermont, we have this opportunity to talk to our neighbors, to be, at the landfill or at the town meeting, or, in my town, we have a weekly coffee klatch. People come together, 30, 40, 50 members of the community, and, remember what's important, that our communities and our neighborliness is important, and supporting one another, and, talking about how is this affecting you? How is this affecting each of us individually? So yeah, I think we have this moment to talk to our neighbors and talk to each other about how this is touching us and why we're crossing some really dangerous lines right here in terms of military power and National Guard being deputized by federal government, that sort of thing. We should be asking our neighbors, really, is this what you bought when you voted for Trump?
Well, Chuck Collins, I want to thank you for joining us once again on the Vermont Conversation.
Thanks, David, for having me.
Chuck Collins co-edits inequality.org and writes the Oligarch Watch column for The Nation. His newest book is Burned by Billionaires: How Concentrated Wealth and Power Are Ruining Our Lives and Planet. That does it for this week's Vermont Conversation. I'm David Goodman. Thanks so much for listening.